across the Pacifica Network and over 40 community radio stations. This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 6, 2002. I'm Max Pringle, standing in for Deepa Fernandez. Republicans regain control of the Senate and expand their hold in the House of Representatives. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon calls for early elections in Israel, and Texas prepares to execute a paranoid schizophrenic. But first, these news headlines. Harvey Pitt, the scandal-plagued head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, resigned last night. The timing of the resignation is raising some eyebrows in Washington. James Cullum reports.
Pitt's recent appointment of William H. Webster to head the new Public Accounting Oversight Board caused even the White House to abandon him. Webster had at one time been the head of the Audit Committee at U.S. Technologies, a company that allegedly fired its outside auditor for publicizing the firm's own accounting failures. White House Chief of Staff Andy Card was reportedly enraged that Pitt failed to share that information with the other SEC commissioners before they voted on Webster. But according to Ellen Franks, an economics professor at Emmanuel College, Harvey Pitt's problems ran much deeper.
Pitt was far too close to the accounting profession at a time when the need for oversight of public auditors is glaringly apparent.
Pitt was a contentious figure who angered Democrats by arguing behind the scenes against new accounting legislation while asking that he be elevated to a cabinet-level position. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
Arizona, Nevada, and Ohio voters shot down three separate measures to soften drug penalties. Evan Davis reports from Columbus, Ohio.
A proposed amendment to Ohio's state constitution that would have mandated rehabilitative treatment as an alternative to incarceration for people convicted of simple possession of illegal drugs was defeated yesterday by a margin of more than 2-1. The initiative was sponsored by the Ohio Campaign for New Drug Policies. Free Speech Radio News spoke with campaign director Rob Stewart.
The initiative is very clear, saying that only people are charged with or convicted of simple possession could qualify. However, it did not provide the objective standard that current criminal justice system is used to. They're used to cut-and-dry amounts of drugs qualifying as, you know, demarcating the line between possession and trafficking. We wanted a court to be able to determine in its judgment whether possession was consistent with personal use. There was an array of organizations united against it, almost all of them connected in some way to the current Taft administration. It was all motivated by the governor and the chiefs of his agencies. We would like to try again, and I know that it will take a little bit of time to assess where we will be in 2004. We already plan to be in other states like Florida and Michigan with similar initiatives.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
In Los Angeles, two ballot measures to split the city into three went down to defeat. Justin Stinchcomb has more from L.A.
Two ballot measures that would have split the San Fernando Valley and Hollywood from Los Angeles failed at the polls yesterday. While San Fernando Valley secession won a slim majority in the valley itself, voters citywide rejected the measure by 2-1. It would have needed majorities in both areas to pass. City voters rejected Hollywood secession by a similar margin. And in Hollywood itself, the measure received only 30% approval. Both secession campaigns sought to capitalize on residents' dissatisfaction with the services provided by City Hall to the sprawling metropolis. But Valley voters clearly feel their needs have been ignored by downtown. Valley secession advocates are vowing they'll be back on the next ballot if the city fails to follow through on recent improvements in city services. And Los Angeles Mayor James Hahn, who mobilized a campaign to oppose secession with $7 million backing, said the city's leadership had learned a valuable lesson. Hahn promised to keep City Hall answerable and accessible to all. In Los Angeles, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Justin Stinchcomb.
In perhaps the most closely watched Senate race, Republican Norm Coleman defeated veteran Politico Walter Mondale in the bid to replace the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. Christoph Keene reports.
After election judges hand-counted more than 2 million supplemental ballots, Mondale conceded to Norm Coleman. Mondale replaced the late Paul Wellstone, killed in a plane crash just 11 days before the election. Coleman's victory has been attributed to response to the Wellstone Memorial Service. The partisan tone of the memorial triggered criticism from both Democrats and Republicans. Coleman also held a slight edge from absentee ballots. Absentee ballots cast for Wellstone were thrown out. Minnesota election law states that a candidate cannot be elected posthumously. Norm Coleman defeated Walter Mondale by a margin of 2%. In Minneapolis, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christoph Keene.
Meanwhile, as President Bush revels in his party's election successes today, the administration presented a final revision of his Iraq resolution to the UN Security Council with no guarantees that U.S.-Iraq policy critics will accept it. In a concession to Russia and France, the new resolution gives Saddam a final opportunity to comply with inspections and offers possible lifting of crippling sanctions. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says the new resolution will be equally resolute. The Council meets again tomorrow. After Tuesday's midterm elections, Republicans regained control of the Senate and expanded their majority in the House of Representatives. Republican candidates beat Democratic incumbents in Missouri, Georgia, and Minnesota to produce at least a 51-vote majority in the Senate. Josh Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill on what the power shift could mean in the next 2 years of President Bush's term.
Democrats were unable to coax enough of their base to the polls with the issues of health care, the economy, and corporate scandal. This morning, new Senate Majority Leader Republican Trent Lott beamed as he walked into a room full of reporters. He chalked up the GOP's successes in part to the events last September.
You cannot ignore the fact that America did change on 9/11. That did have an effect on this election. People do want security here at home. I think they do have confidence in this president's leadership in fighting the war on terror and taking on the Al-Qaeda.
Pacifica Radio's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky would seem to agree with Senator Lott's assessment.
All of the things that people traditionally vote on, as far as government's concerned, the Bush administration very cleverly and expertly managed to get out of the media focus and the political focus for a couple of months while they were waving around Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and smallpox and anthrax and anything else they could to scare people into thinking that they had to vote Republican.
But Republicans argue today that American voters were simply tired of congressional gridlock. Again, Senator Lott.
People I talk to don't understand why we can't get an energy bill through that would give us energy security along with national security, homeland security, and economic security.
Well, I think Mr. Lott might be disproportionately counting the voices of energy industry campaign contributors who certainly favored Republican candidates.
Lisa Gew is energy analyst with the consumer group Public Citizen.
The nuclear industry spent more than $5 million on campaign contributions this election, and we can see that the vast majority of their candidates, if I can put it that way, have won.
Gew says the Republican energy bill is a payout to polluting industry with few incentives for conservation or alternative energy development. She says environmentalists and consumer advocates have their work cut out for them against the new Republican Congress. Labor unions may lose ground, too. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney warned today that Republicans are hot to take away protections American workers have traditionally enjoyed. And at the Institute for Democracy Studies in New York, Lee Cocorinos says the same goes for advocates of reproductive choice.
Orrin Hatch is going to become chair now of the Judiciary Committee, and a whole raft of radical right-wing nominees that were sent up by the Bush administration are now going to probably be put on the federal judiciary. There's going to be much more activity, I expect, on abortion rights, state-level challenges that had been contained to a certain extent at the appellate level, I think, are now possibly going to go through.
Cocorino says affirmative action programs are also on the chopping block. And if Sandra Day O'Connor steps down, as many predict, the Bush team may get the opportunity to appoint a Supreme Court justice. The 107th Congress is unlikely to accomplish much when it comes back to work next week. The balance of power in the Senate remains uncertain for the remainder of the session. The 108th Congress starts work under Republican control in early January. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
President Bush's younger brother Jeb became the first Republican governor to win re-election in Florida, but that was the only unusual result in yesterday's election in the southern state. There were scattered reports of voting irregularities that included not enough Spanish-speaking poll workers, people who got frustrated with the long wait, and an historically long ballot of state constitutional amendments. Most disturbing were the reports from the voters who said the new touchscreen voting machines overrode their choice and cast a vote for the wrong candidates. Yet, when all the complaints are tallied, Bush still won Florida with more than 600,000 votes. Randy Zimmerman reflects on the election.
It would have been virtually impossible for Jeb to lose in Florida. Even before his brother made it to the White House, he held a surprisingly high approval rating around the state. On election night, the ballroom at the posh Renaissance Hotel in Miami was painted red, Jeb's campaign color, with party loyalists paying $6 for a cocktail. Reporters were treated to a room of their own, electric outlets, internet connections, and free soft drinks. All were confident and bubbly that the governor would claim 4 more years. But across the street from the hotel and half a dozen news trucks, about 50 Haitians, Haitian Americans, and their supporters were waving signs and shouting for justice. There have been protests every day for a week since a boatload of 200 people, most of them from Haiti, tried to reach Florida last week. Scores of Haitians are being held in the Chrome Detention Center in southeast Florida, some since December, as the INS considers their asylum applications. One activist who identified himself as People Power knows exactly what he would ask of the governor if the governor would listen.
Equal right and justice for all. We all are one. Doesn't matter what part of the Caribbean you come from. Everybody got here on boat. Even Christopher Columbus that said discover America, he come here on a boat.
Current INS policy allows Cubans who reach the U.S. mainland to stay. All others who are assumed to be coming to the United States for economic reasons are sent back unless they meet certain criteria as created and evaluated by the INS. Few other journalists paid much attention to the protesters or their message. One group of student journalists from Puerto Rico came specifically to observe the elections in Miami-Dade. Myra Cuevas is a master's student at Florida International University.
Basically, you have inside CBS, CNN, you have ABC, you have all the major news centers right there, and there's not one that besides CBS and Channel 7 that have come out here and interviewed these people and show the world that there's more than what's going on in a hotel room with the Jeb Bush party campaign and some stiff old guys that gave him money.
Shortly after this interview, the police, who had already taped off the protesters, scuttled the journalists, including this reporter, into another taped-off area more than 50 feet from the demonstrators. The city police officer told us the order was issued by the Secret Service and asked us to be patient as they separated us.
It's not illegal. I never said it was illegal. What I'm saying is, just let us do our thing. Just keep it this way. Okay. Okay, that's good. I understand. And this is my job to do this. So I hope you understand that too.
Cuevas and her compatriots were appalled at what they observed during the course of the elections.
We just arrived from Puerto Rico 2 months ago, and today we've seen the hypocrisy that is the electoral system in the United States.
The Broward supervisor of elections promised that everyone who came to the polls would be able to vote on Election Day by provisional ballot if necessary. Yet even after tens of millions of dollars were spent on new machines, training, and a massive multi-department countywide effort, there was little consistency at the polls, no matter where or when voters went. Overall, early voting went well around the state, allowing registered voters an opportunity for close to 2 weeks prior to the election to go to designated offices and cast their ballot. Political analysts said beating Bush required high voter turnout, yet little more than 34% cast a ballot in Broward when the day was over. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Randy Zimmerman in Hollywood, Florida.
Election results in Florida also indicate Floridians approved an amendment to incorporate the death penalty into its constitution. Meanwhile, Texas is set to execute 42-year-old James Coburn 1 day after the elections. Coburn was declared fit to be executed for stabbing and strangling Peggy Murphy 8 years ago. But death penalty opponents note that as a teen, Coburn was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic and was heavily sedated during his trial. Renee Feltz reports from Houston.
If there was ever a case in which the U.S. Supreme Court should have intervened to stop an execution, it is this one.
That was Joe Lovelace, public policy coordinator for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, responding to yesterday's United States Supreme Court decision to deny James Coburn a stay of execution. The ruling has Lovelace, whose association opposes the death penalty for people with serious and persistent mental illness, alarmed but not surprised. Coburn is the third seriously mentally ill death row prisoner to be executed by Texas this year. Convicted killers Jamar Arnold and Monty Delk received lethal injections after unsuccessfully raising similar mental illness arguments. At the time Colburn murdered Peggy Murphy, he was receiving irregular outpatient treatment for paranoid schizophrenia from the state. While awaiting trial in jail, he was repeatedly refused medical treatment. But during the trial, he received injections of Haldol, an antipsychotic drug and powerful sedative that prevented him from being fully alert, Lovelace explains.
Many of the jurors interpreted that as being a person who had no soul, who did not care, who was not remorseful.
The prosecution argued Colburn was just mean, fully competent to stand trial, and had a rational understanding of the proceedings. Colburn's current attorney, James Ridding, argues the jury was not made adequately aware of his mental status.
Jurors that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to two in particular, said that the seriousness of Mr. Colburn's mental illness was never explained to them the way that they felt it should be. For example, there was only the court-appointed psychologist testifying. The psychologist that was retained by the defense was left at home.
Critics of Colburn's conviction say there are many prisoners in Texas who obviously suffer from mental illness that's not taken into account when they receive death sentences. Lovelace.
It's quite ironic now that the state would want to impose the death penalty upon their own patient that they failed to adequately treat.
Part of the problem is the state's rank of 47 in the nation on spending for treatment of the mentally ill. Many of those who fail to receive treatment become part of the criminal justice system. On death row, prisoners who are locked in their cells for 23 hours a day develop further mental illness problems. Lovelace.
He deteriorated on death row to the point that he was psychotic and eating his own feces. And the state of Texas was able to gather together what they needed to treat him back to a state of competency so that they could now kill him.
The United Nations Commission on Human Rights has repeatedly called on the United States not to impose the death penalty on a person suffering from any form of mental disorder or to execute any such person. Colburn is scheduled to be executed at the Walsh Unit in Huntsville, Texas, at 6 p.m. Central Time, Wednesday. I'm Renee Feltz in Houston, Texas, for Free Speech Radio News.
An Oregon measure to label genetically engineered food was defeated yesterday by a margin of 27% to 73%. Sevilla Mann of the Urbana Independent Media Center reports.
Measure 27, which would have required food producers to label genetically engineered ingredients in food produced or sold in Oregon, lost in one of the most expensive opposition campaigns in the history of the state. Oregon would have been the first state to require such labeling. The labeling measure was fought by food and biotechnology companies such as Monsanto, DuPont, General Mills, and Pepsi, who formed the Coalition Against the Costly Labeling Law. The campaign spent over $5 million, outspending labeling advocates 25-1. Craig Winters, the executive director of the Campaign to Label Genetically Engineered Foods, a major proponent of the measure, explains this defeat.
Basically, by repeating a lie over and over again and having the budget to put it on TV and hammer it home so many times and us not having the money to come back and say, no, that's not right, they're misrepresenting the facts, that they were able to make that lie stick, basically, and convince the Oregon voters that their prices of groceries were going to go up.
Most of the opposition's budget was spent in the last few weeks on TV and radio ads such as this one.
Measure 27 would force Oregon farmers to use a complex, misleading food labeling scheme no other state requires. It would increase our production costs, increase food prices, and put Oregon food products at a huge competitive disadvantage. It would also cost taxpayers millions for more government bureaucrats and red tape.
The opposition estimates that mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods would cost more than $500 a year for a family of four. The proponents of labeling, as well as academics, have placed the cost at less than $10 a year per person, using figures from countries such as Australia, where labeling is required. But supporters say that the fundamental struggle over labeling is whether consumers are able to choose if they eat genetically engineered food. John Stauber, the executive director of PR Watch in Madison, comments.
We hear the giant companies that are the biotech industry, like DuPont and Monsanto, always praising the market, the free market. But the market can only work if people are able to make informed choices. Surveys show that once people find out that this food has not been adequately safety tested and may be unsafe for humans and the environment, they're not interested in eating it.
In the wake of defeat, labeling advocates are applauding the national attention the issue has received.
Even though we lost the actual initiative battle, we won, we feel, in regards to raising awareness of the issue up in the country, that before the Measure 27 was on the ballot in Oregon, very few Americans were really aware of this, and as a result of Measure 27 being on the ballot in Oregon, all the major media around the country has run articles on it.
The campaign to label genetically engineered foods has made its next step to introduce labeling laws on the city, county, and state levels throughout the country. Winters explains why.
To create so much grassroots activities with these city and county resolutions, with the state initiatives and the state bills, that it's going to be impossible for the biotech industry to come in and focus on one target like they were able to do in Oregon.
This is Sevilla Man with Danielle Shinwith.
As Americans went to the polls yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon called for early elections set for January. Israelis will vote for the new Knesset 9 months ahead of schedule. Before the January elections, both major political parties, the right-wing Likud and the left-leaning Labor, will hold primaries. In the Likud primaries, Sharon will campaign to defend his leadership from his newly appointed foreign minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Israelis are furious and despairing at being dragged to the polls early for their fifth election in 10 years, and the impact for the conflict with the Palestinians is a continuation of the present stalemate with no new policies for the next 3 months until the January election.
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said on Monday that Israel shouldn't have to endure the expense and trouble of an early election. But on Tuesday, he called one anyway. I wanted this government to continue now and in the future, says Prime Minister Sharon. But the complex political challenges of the moment make calling an early election the responsible and the least worst option. Mr. Sharon said talks with the right-wing and religious parties had broken down, giving him no choice but to go back to the people. Israel has had 5 prime ministers in 7 years, and these dramatic developments underscore the growing political volatility here. Reaction within Israel has been furious at the waste of time and money. The elections will cost $100 million at a time when Israel's economy is in crisis, and an annual survey published this week shows that 1 in 5 Israeli families live in poverty, as do 2 in 5 Palestinian families. The editorial in Israel's largest daily newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, says that the Israeli political system has failed miserably. The rule of one main party resulted in corruption. The division of the parties into factions has brought anarchy. Even the president of Israel, Moshe Katsav, made it plain he opposed early elections. While this security situation continues, while ever the wave of terror attacks are part of our daily reality, says President Katsav, I think this nation needs a government of national unity. This is no time for party politics. National interests have to prevail. But party politics are obscuring the national interest, for both parties face leadership ballots before the election. So though Israelis know they are going to the polls, they do not know who will lead either party at the election. Perhaps most significant is that the stalemate on the Palestinian issue will continue. Prime Minister Sharon could make no meaningful concessions to the Palestinians, even if he wanted to, while he's marking time until the elections. Palestinian reaction to political events within Israel has been muted, with leaders saying only that they hoped Israel would elect a government that could deliver peace. What is certain is that instability in the Middle East has increased at exactly the time when the United States is contemplating military action in Iraq. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
The situation for the world's women and girls is worsening, according to a recent United Nations report, which found that they are too often victims of violence. Susan Wood has more from the UN.
Women and girls are not incidental victims of contemporary warfare. Increasingly, they are its targets. That's the conclusion of a new report released last week by the United Nations Development Fund for Women, or UNIFEM. Independent experts Ellen Johnson-Sirleaf and Elizabeth Rain visited 14 conflict-ridden nations and territories, including Colombia, Israel, Palestine, and Johnson-Sirleaf's own country, Liberia. She says everywhere they went, the story was the same.
It's a story of women subjected to domestic violence, to rape, to abduction, to trafficking, to forced prostitution. We were very shocked ourselves. We were not prepared for the intensity of the suffering to which women are subjected in times of conflict.
That's not news to Angelina Atiam. She's from northern Uganda, where a little-known war has been raging for nearly two decades between the government and a rebel group called the Lord's Resistance Army. Some 14,000 children have been kidnapped and held hostage by the LRA, including Atiam's daughter Charlotte. Half the population of northern Uganda has been crowded into displaced persons camps, where, says Atiam, women and girls are routinely raped, tortured, and infected with HIV. She says the situation is dire.
We need help, and we need it very urgently. Every single second that takes away means human lives lost, blood spilling. For 17 years, the guns have been rattling, and we are saying, can anybody help us get a peaceful solution to this conflict?
Atiam, who is co-founder and chair of the Concerned Parents Association, a local group working for the release of all abducted children, is asking the UN Security Council to send a fact-finding mission to northern Uganda. She believes council members could persuade Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni to accept a humanitarian and peace mission as well. Museveni, a key recipient of U.S. military aid, has vowed to crush the LRA. But Atiam, noting that kidnap victims make up 85% of the rebel forces, says women have a better way.
The government have an amnesty law which is in place, but the rebels don't trust that. But women are on the ground very committed. We have been talking to the rebels and we have been calling upon them to lay down their arms and come home and give back the children so that they can be rehabilitated.
Women's organizations say in order to harness women's potential as peacemakers, a broader vision is needed. Aisha Daifan is with the International Women's Tribune Center.
We have to redefine security. In the eyes of the international community and the men who make this decision, peace is only seen within the context of armaments and all of these things. There's human security.
That means putting human rights and needs first, say women's groups. They're asking the Security Council to consult with Iraqi women before voting on a U.S. and British proposal to authorize war with Iraq. They're also calling on governments to prosecute those responsible for war crimes, which under international law now include rape and trafficking of women. Elizabeth Rain of Finland co-authored the UNIFEM report.
We have heard many times that you can't change the culture of war, because it has always been through history that women are raped, girls are abused. But I don't think that in the year 2002 we have to accept it. We have all the conventions, we have agreements, we have the United Nations. There should be no impunity for anyone who has committed crimes against women.
Following a two-day open meeting in which more than 35 countries participated, the Security Council called for stricter disciplinary measures against sexual exploitation of women and girls during peace and humanitarian operations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.